Blog Talk Radio.
Control here. It's delayed. It's sloppy. It's today. So I'll just explain. We're slightly behind because of we broadcast through Skype, and the connection was just not forthcoming. There's never really an explanation. It really doesn't matter. Well, anyway. You found us, and welcome, and especially welcome to Brazil. There are listeners from Brazil and India and Russia and France and the UK and the United States and Canada. Hello. It occurs to me something's just come. I hope you've had a reasonable week, I think we have another interesting commentary for you today, but it comes with a little bit of context. There's renewed effort, I think, by some organizations to be aware, be mindful of issues of the order that relate to privacy and secrecy. And I think it's an interesting phenomenon. Our whole notions of privacy and secrecy have undergone an interesting metamorphosis because we're living in a world where even with transparency, our suspicions and our cynicism toward governments and corporations doesn't necessarily fade. Not that it would, not that we're living in a totalitarian state where even if the sun comes up, we probably won't find agreement that it's the most beautiful sunset ever or that it's a remarkable day coming because opinions vary. And we shouldn't be challenged or disappointed by that. If you thought that you and I were thinking like everybody else and everybody else was thinking like me and you, that would be a very tedious and unfamiliar and uncomfortable and I think a frightening kind of an existence for us because we wouldn't necessarily have a direction. If you think about it, what direction should we go in? Well, if everybody is in a lot, is in step, everybody is in step, there's really not one to set the pace. And I keep thinking, maybe would I be like the sheep, you know, just some, for whatever reason, one heads off through a hole in the fence, and all the other members of the flock line up behind and follow. I find it kind of comical, and it's an interesting aspect of that kind of herd. We're much different. So today, notions of privacy and secrecy have changed. Not necessarily, and I think not necessarily holus boldus. There's a dignity that goes with notions of loyalty and commitment, and some, you know, we mix that up. I don't think we can have the discussion about privacy and secrecy without talking about what's the secret, you know, without talking about some element of loyalty. If I give you my word, it came to I want your feedback from the gene pool out there, the experts in the world. We start off in masonry asserting certain beliefs, underlining the teachings that are given to us, and then we make oaths to validate our commitment. And I think that's a remarkable feeling. There's always been the question that, you know, if you're not a believer in a higher power, then how can you take an oath? You know, I don't know. I leave that more for, it goes a little bit beyond what I understand about natural law. So I don't think I'm in a good position to comment on that. But something that does trouble me at times is, why are we given so many other chances? What if we were given one oath, one obligation, and all of the other appended orders were and did not? What kind of a world would we be, what kind of a Masonic environment would we be functioning in? It would be different. Would there be an advantage for the man, for the person, for the woman, to know that if you take this obligation, it's a once in a lifetime obligation. When I joined an appended order, I'm a member of different orders. That's been a bit gobsmacked by all of the information going on around me, all of the ideas being fed to me, and at some point I determined that I felt compelled that I could not continue on unless I understood what was going on around me, in all fairness, so that I could make qualified statements, not just glib comments. If somebody asked me a question, was I going to answer because I was asked the question? But, you know, I'm sorry, after a time, I really needed to moderate those my answers, not to say anybody else should follow this path at all. Never. You make your decisions and determinations and your oaths based on the character that you are. If it matters nothing to you, then it matters nothing to you. But I couldn't. And one reading led to another, and it's not that I'm any more disconnected from the orders. I'm more connected than ever, I feel. I occasionally attend ritual because it's important to me. And I now, when I attend a ritual, I'm absolutely riveted. I'm not doing things. For a while, I'll confess to you, I was doing things out of rote. And it was like, you know, it's, for me, it was like, you know, there were certain things that were buried in if you didn't ask the questions, you weren't taught. And I thought that was remarkable. I don't think one would have ideas one way or the other about that. I think if a person doesn't know and they don't ask, then fine, it's not important to them. My dear wife doesn't distinguish between a glass of Cabernet Sauvignon and a glass of Merlot. Okay, I do. So, you know, it's not coexistence. It's each to his or her own. That's her taste. She nevertheless enjoys a glass of wine. So it's not a crossroads. I'm along that path. And the journey that is in front of me is curious and getting more curious each and every day. I look behind me at history to tell me where I've been, to give me a bit of an idea of where I'm going, you know? Not that it's a competition with any one of you. I'm not one of those fellows that needs to climb the mountain and then come to your party and brag about it, or sail the ocean, or you know, trip around the Borneo jungles. No, it's not. Life isn't a competition. Life's a challenge. And there's times when most of the time when it's quite serious. And if we're very fortunate, we find contentment and love and beauty, and we begin to understand the things that enrich our experience. The struggle is daunting. Our brothers and sisters who are struggling for shelter and water and food, what's the emotion that we extend to them? Here, we're not a violent nation, where I am. We don't base our ethos on violence and domination and superiority. We base our notions of nationality on common purpose, on the appreciation of security and predictability and safety and concern for our fellow man. Oh, we have our opponents. I also come from this place. Up until just a couple of years ago, we had leadership that censored our scientists. It's imperfect. But that was like, you know, the difference between weather and climate. If we ever extrapolate and say, well, today, you know, it's raining, so that's a benchmark for the climate. Well, that would be a bit ridiculous. Good, it would be a bit ridiculous, because climate is what happens when you start to think about the overall, the accumulative knowledge. I think of it like this: you're looking up at the stars one night, and you assume, oh, this is the position of all the stars. That's where they are. But the next night we find, and if we find that the stars seem to move, we move. We're on this big ball that's moving around at what, 56,000 kilometers an hour. We move relative to all of that magic in the sky, and they're all in different orbits and moving. So it's changeable. And so our perspective changes, and each one of us has that. But we hold certain things in common, and we enjoy that experience. What's the point here, Graham? Point is that understanding is, I feel, something that is compelling. There are many, doesn't mean that we're in a constant state like this. Nothing's constant. it doesn't mean that every single moment of every single day we're in a state of contemplation. We may be if we understand principles of mindfulness. Mindfulness, that awareness, yeah? Deep and liberating insight. It's a process inside of us to bring our attention to experiences occurring in the present moment. We live in the moment. It's a translation of the Pali term sati, is mindfulness. The significant element of Buddhist tradition. In Buddhist teachings, mindfulness was utilized to develop self-knowledge and wisdom that gradually led to what is described as enlightenment, or the complete freedom from suffering. And the popularity, for whatever reason, was initiated by a fellow who is considered generally by Jon Kabat-Zinn. But what we're finding is the practice of mindfulness is strongly correlated with greater well-being and perceived health. And I think in some ways, masonry has been a vehicle, a portal, a window to mindfulness. What's the betterment? What's the point of all of what we go through and what we commit to? Well, the point is a recognition or a reaffirmation that life is good. And life is a struggle. Life has purpose. And we share that. And life is imperfect. And we can exaggerate the purposefulness and the wrongness of what goes on around us. But to what end? Life goes on. Always has. And will it into the future? Well, we know at a certain point, does the math matter? Well, yeah, it should. Mathematics is our sun. We have a rough calculation about when the sun will deplete its energy. And then what? Well, you know, we are dependent on that little rascal in the sky. So does it matter to the masses? Well, right now, day by day, if I'm in Puerto Rico and my family are wandering through hip deep waters and the leadership the bureaucracy isn't responsive to meet the need, it's like I'd be feeling like I'm slipping below the surface of the water and afraid of the murk that I'm floating in, while the bureaucrats are discussing who should jump in and save me. So life is like that. Masonry is part of that genre of mindfulness. It's not new. I think this is happening. This awareness or concern is happening because of the aging population. Oh, some of us are still acting like we live in an agrarian culture and that we close our eyes and we're looking out over fields of wheat and corn and beans. But for many of us now around the world, there's been a lovely, lovely term, urbanization. We moved to larger cities where we produce, and that creates opportunity. And our populations become better educated. And thank you. And we're grateful. And that means that expectations increase. Doesn't mean the struggle necessarily increases, and it doesn't mean that everybody is on the bus at the same time. The good part is that many years ago, you remember hearing about salons, gatherings of people, gatherings of men. I'll speak in the English context, not necessarily the European and French context right now. Well, I'm just thinking about the history of the coffee house. Britain, women weren't there. In France, they were. To start, the salon, where casual conversation, where exchange of ideas happened, where there was socialization. The interesting part is that the fun part is if we think about sitting around the cities during 16th century, and if we had a couple of coins in our pocket and we were fortunate, or we had an inheritance, or we were connected somehow politically, we were a small number. We were a relatively small number, the gentry. Well, it's kind of interesting, isn't it, that our means of production has led to the establishment of the gentry once again. The rich have been allowed to, enabled to take the opportunities available to them and accumulate so much wealth. But now we have a bigger picture. We're mindful of the fact that there is such a term as exploitation. Now, everybody in the world doesn't subscribe to that notion. Capitalism doesn't subscribe to the notion of exploitation. But somebody's working for low income in sweatshops. It's the image that comes to my mind. Child labor, it's still going on. The slavery, human trafficking, still going on. But there's an exchange. What masonry, the value of masonry, isn't that it comes or goes, but that it appeals. It appeals to a sense, a deeper sense of purpose and meaning. Not the storefront aspects. Those are lovely. There's nothing at all wrong with them, but that's not a complete picture. I'm talking about the enormous works of charity and dedication. Talk about loyalty. Speak about loyalty. You know, investing in research based on need. Oh, a meritocracy? No, I don't think so. I think that's because that's something that we strive to achieve. That's just organizational theory. That's not the genius. That's not the imagination. That's the architecture. That's just if you say, I'm going to create something architecturally beautiful. Well, we find that, you know, the beauty in architecture comes from the imagination, from the statement. If it's Christopher Wren or Wright or, you know, the architecture is as much that fusion of art and mathematics, of genius, huh? When you think about it, you know, are you thinking about, you know, the Empire State Building or the Guggenheim Museum or, you know, the Parthenon or the Leaning Tower of Pisa or the Colosseum or the Sydney Opera House or the Burj Khalifa and Dubai. You know, it's the amazement. What comes to your mind that amazes and inspires? That those are the rule breakers. Those are the rule breakers. And some of that is accumulated history. Where I live, we haven't discovered that there's much worth saving. Most of our architecture is pedestrian. So if it wears out, we knock it down. Oh, we will get to, you know, when we're 500 years old, we will get to the point where we'll have some beautiful things around us that are worth preserving. And very gradually, that our architecture, like yours, will start to define us culturally. And will also define our sense of purpose. How to do all of these things? And what do you talk, do we talk about these things when we're in the salon? Well, I think we do. Let Masonic Effects reassure you. We struggle here with the depth of secrecy and privacy that you're talking about. If you're a part of the paranoid group like me, we would not speak about anything. And I come from a day, Masonically, when I'm taught that nothing was mentioned. The word was not even mentioned. But I know the reality was much different. The reality was much different. Oh, we joke today about, you know, somebody getting help from family members with their work and obligations. Now, I have to admit, my grandfather wasn't one of them, and I don't subscribe to that theory either. But I've heard a lot of people sort of joking about it. No, I'm that's revealing our work, our private, most private moments to somebody who's not obligated. I find that a bit troubling, but apparently that's not what we're talking about here. Masonry is a beautiful, beautiful process. But if I was to say it's simple, in its essence, it is. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. The golden rule that permeates all of the major religions and beliefs of the world, of mankind. But as I see you as a Mason, having been not coming into the world, but coming out of it, you pump all of that stardust around in your system and struggle with the notions of mortality, that all that energy that is within you doesn't dissolve, it is recycled. Here, walk with me a little bit. We'll get into the commentary, Masons at Work, Seekers of Light. Mm-hmm. Here's a little something for the people in the Northern Hemisphere, just because we've passed through the equinox. This is some music called Autumn Leaves. It'll be familiar to a lot of you. This version is done by a beautiful singer, Paula Cole. And
the autumn drifts by my window, the autumn leaves of red and gold. I see your lips
I'd say that's a keeper, wouldn't you? Yeah. Beautiful music. No, I haven't forgotten about our friends in the Southern Hemisphere. Don't think otherwise. It's not fate. We're not facing autumn everywhere. Did you top up your favorite beverage if you have a chance? Whether you're sitting at home or you're driving around or you're walking, listening to this. As I've heard, some people just tape it and then listen to it at their leisure. I love that. Here's a commentary for you. And I'll preface it a little bit. What kind of ideas and things do you talk about at your salon? It may not be formal. I tend to think that, you know, a few years ago we heard some aspiring, brilliant minds, very, very bright minds, talking about, you know, bringing the notion of a salon to the jurisdiction that I'm in. And I thought at the time, and I still do, that it was a lovely idea, a bit premature, and I thought that it was a, it was like what they were trying to do was like what some of my superiors attempted many, many years ago, maybe 30 years ago. They were calling meetings so that we could brainstorm. I'm pretty sure you've heard about that, and come up with clever ideas. And I'll be darned, I just couldn't come up with clever ideas on demand. I just couldn't. Just, you know, it just faulted me. So I don't expect you to do that. If some of the work that you hear, part some of the ideas resonate with you, albeit that, you know, you've filtered them through your own filters and you use what you need. And I appreciate that. I do. Masons at Work. And this describes you as seekers of light. Maybe you'll bring this to the salon and see, bounce it off of some of your friends and see what they think. It's a part of the secrets that are ever present all around us. I don't think of mindfulness as unlocking the secrets of the universe, or secrets of the mind or consciousness or character. I don't think that way. But I'll give it a homage. Let's consider this a homage to those thinkers. What do? When we can't quite see the light, you and I, to ensure the passion that gripped us during initiation continues to encourage, is at times like trying with a firm grip drops flowing through our fingers. The great mystery of our order is embracing and then discovering our spiritual self in very subtle and abstract ways. Our order cannot and would not compel us to study. That drive comes from within. Truly the embodiment of Galileo's thoughts on teaching and learning. You cannot teach a man anything. You can only help him find it within. Or as a dear friend of mine more recently said, people believe what they want to believe. Occasionally we have an experience of a man who is most vulnerable, incredibly intelligent, kind, authentic, and sincere. The greatest minds cannot prepare us for discovery. What do we do when we can't quite see the light? The answer, when it is discovered, is a form of understanding that we hold close. How then do we apply this knowledge, this awareness, to our lives? This is for you folks, you listeners, that are facing spring. It's coming.
Then you will spend your and you say
Jones. It works. Didn't mean to press too hard on that button about salons and what we discuss. It's what do you discuss and what do you think about Masonically when you need to, when you want to. And whether you come with this craving to sit down and have a thoughtful discussion and your lodge is busy at the work of all the domestic care of the lodge. Bills have to be paid and functions have to be organized and ritual needs to be sharpened and mentors need to mentor. So we don't always have things at our fingertips. So what do you bring when you need to? Well, I don't think we walk around with this sense, although you've seen them too. Masons walking around this with a sense of dread or no sense of humor. Everything is ultimately severe. They have much to learn. Some keep their head buried in the sand. In the meantime, I'm going to be talking to a group in a couple of days about the ancient charges. Now, all of you Masons will be able to access those. And I'd appreciate if you did. If you need a reminder, take this as the reminder you require. In the past here on this version of that salon that just keeps on rolling, a conversation that never really seems to come to an end. We can talk about the roots of the organization and the start, but I lose track. It's like I would no more be concerned about, which was the first department store, who was the first merchant. Do I know the first brand was that little red triangle on a bottle of Bass Ale? Yeah, well, it's sort of extrivia, isn't it? It's just these things that are just out there for what. And I think masonry, we can do that as well. But always interesting when we talk about why. Why was that little brand, what motivated people to put a brand on something recognizable, a little mark, and then to preserve it as a mark of quality. Well, that's you. You're the embodiment of a mark of quality. Oh, I know that may be an affront to some of you, and certainly this isn't said in any way to encourage you to become overbearing. Oh my goodness, no, far from it. This is the voice of somebody who believes very sincerely that leadership is a service to people, that use of authority is a loss of leadership, especially to people who are suffering from micromanagers. You're suffering from those people that are so anxious they need to have that kind of interference in order to convince themselves they're in control. Interesting, isn't it? No. Here, just to set this up a little bit, I wanted to talk to you about, just bring up my, you know, if you're looking at influences here, I want to just share, incredibly influenced by the work of Cicero, Marcus Tullius Cicero, the leader in the medieval times. The name was anglicized to Tully. This guy was first century BC, 106 BC, he was born. And he was assassinated on the 7th of December in Italy, Formia, in 7 December of 43 BC. Considered one of the greatest Roman orators, son of wealth and privilege of the equestrian group, a statesman. He said nice little things. If you have a garden and a library, you have everything you need. A room without books is like a body without a soul. But here's the two guiding principles that I want to speak with you about. Keep in mind, he said, true law is right reason in agreement with nature. So reason in agreement with nature. It is of universal application, unchanging, and everlasting. It summons to duty by its commands. It summons to duty by its commands and averts from wrongdoing by its prohibitions. He claimed that was true law. But he also said the distinguishing property of man is to search for and follow after truth. I think that has a bearing on our order, more than we care to admit or to acknowledge. Care to admit? I'm just going to throw this out. I want you to get your pen or paper, pencil, and write these four statements down. You can do this as this little teaser. Back in Eton, mathematics used to be used as entertainment before we had all of the different forms of entertainment. We didn't have access to musicians or poets or orators or actors. This is a little mathematical test from a puzzle, entertainment from back in the day. And the question I want to ask you, the first statement is, how many statements are true? There's going to be four statements, okay? None of these statements are true. Second, exactly one of these statements is true. And next, exactly two of these statements are true. Next, all of these statements are true. A, B, C, D, and E. So the question to you is, how many statements of those four are true? None of them, one of them, two of them, three of them, four of them. Isn't that entertaining? I hope we encourage you here to read. I hope we do. It's important. Now, humility, I spoke about that just a little earlier. So if you look at, of course, you all have your copy of Machiavelli's Discourses open in front of you. Oh, my goodness, I hope you're drinking something stronger than spring water. We're talking about the motives of a citizen. Like the desire to free his country that has been seized by somebody malevolent. We do that at our workplace, and we do that in the marketplace. And the man was so well read. He's quoting a Juvenal here. He said, "How many of all the boastful men that reign descend in peace to Pluto's dark domain. You're in peace when you're, you know, Pluto's dark domain. Go and read about that. You know, that's what does Pluto reign over? Some of you will know that more than others. Everybody wants me to find tranquility in the insight. But to do that, we need to go through and understand turmoil and conflict and all that is part of real life. Real life isn't easy. And there's deceit and there's hubris, you know, the thing that was at one point outlawed in Rome, hubris. And then it was argued and taken out of the law. And then we see it being bragged about, you know, the bling, people that are flaunting their wealth and are riding on celebrity when they're not really contributing to, I don't think they contribute to the discussion of what's really going on around us. You know, so I'm just giving you little samplers here of some readings and material. Whether you find a quick note, go to there's student notes on all of these readings. So I wouldn't necessarily run out and buy a new book, although there is a new book out on William Hogarth, the painter. And I would suggest very strongly that you take a look at it and consider adding it to your library. Hogarth, you know the one. The interesting work that reveals more about the painter. And he was the first, when we started, just a little bit of trivia here. When the order was formed, it was 1717 in England, let me say. That wasn't the first, but it was. It's significant, you know, it's important. There wasn't 3 degrees, but 1725, the third was added. And this fellow is said to be one of the very first persons who experienced that part of the ritual. Can you imagine? Can you imagine? Go back to that day and just imagine what it was like. And the excitement in the room. And then we sit back and sort of, you know, mull that over and think, you know, did that work? And did we put enough work into the creation of it? And was there enough? You can rest assured there were arguments and debates that this was not something that was handled lightly. This was something, and even the notion, you know, you'd have to sit down with your historians and historiographers and philosophers and diplomats and scientists. Can you imagine? Fascinating. We're so fortunate. For those of you who haven't had the Masonic experience, I can't and wouldn't share that with you because it comes at a price, and you need to pay that price. That's an individual choice. And so I could not make that choice for you. So if you're an interloper listening, you're welcome to hear this. You're welcome to eavesdrop at the salon here. Not a problem. The ideas are enrich the experience of life. When we're talking about architecture, there's no secret there. Or the work of Cicero. The secret is if you want to suss it out, go and find it. The experience, though, I don't know if I would say sacrifice or the acknowledgement or the mindfulness. What comes of mindfulness? You know, that exploration of the internal, of the depth of the mind. So we have writings of people, and we know of people, writings about people, biographies and histories, who have developed great insights. But to read those histories doesn't necessarily allow us to assume the insights that they learned. So we're the basis of our thinking here is to encourage and assist a person to find their insights within themselves. And my goodness, that's daunting, because we have to scratch our head and wonder, where do I start? Where do I begin? And does it mean I'm going to be sounding like him? No, you failed, I failed, if you're sounding like anybody else. The notion of being able to embrace your own ideas comes when you're not saying things because somebody else said them to you, that you're saying things that are coming from within you. I always find that that we represent ourselves very well when we represent a mature aspect. And how many of the ideas are in rough form? They come out in rough form with a bit of temper or irritation, as if this notion is the only notion in the conversation that is worth considering. Childish, really. Yeah, childish. And tedious and unpleasant. For the likes of me, I've reached a point of age where I'm impatient with that type of thing. And imagine some of you know exactly what I'm talking about, speaking about. You capture, are you changed when you, when beauty, when you experience beauty? Yeah, I think so. And does it put a different perspective on the grind and the grimness of day-to-day life? Yeah. It is an assault, in a way, to cynicism, to the cynicism that smugness that almost considers it impertinent if you don't share it, that the impertinence of it all. More than ever, we live in a point right now around the globe where people are being set adrift. The institutes that they felt they could trust and rely upon are falling. And those folks are good people. They're going to need role models or opportunities. And they may be investing in opportunities that may not seriously have considered not so very many years ago. Masons, you are the embodiment, not by what you say, but by what you do, how you carry yourself. When people begin to understand or become aware that you are a Freemason, a Mason. Where else do you find this? And when people are standing up on their back heels saying, you know, we're being prosecuted and persecuted, we look at the evidence and we know, yeah, they are. And, when I was a boy, this country only had 18 million people in it, less than that. So today it's much bigger and better for it. But it was a different time. And, of course, I had the awareness of a boy, not somebody that's experienced life the way I have now. All of you. We become aware as Masons. We can allow ourselves that. And we conduct acts. We've gone through a period where we were wrestling with this notion of how to define ourselves publicly. I always thought that was like a really interesting book trying to sell itself. I don't think the really interesting and important books have to sell themselves. I think we do that for them. There's material around us that we're still reading. Some of the plays are hundreds and hundreds of years old, the operas, the music, the ideas. A war is never undertaken by the ideal state except in defense of its honor or its safety. Once you've turned into a murderous lot, they find that the whole, all, if I was listening to a psychologist a couple of years ago, and he had a little poster. It was brilliant. If all you have in your toolbox are hammers, then the rest of us all look like nails. Wow. Check this out. This is from Gothenburg. Thank you, Sweden. Nice work. Nice work, Sweden. Nice work. You know that. that comes along kind of simple, but a bit bluesy, and a nice rhythm to it. And who could ask for anything more? Anyway, we're drawing to a close here. I want to leave you with just a little bit of some connections with our past. This is, you know, some really interesting history. When, you know, I was taught that, you know, the roots of Masonry were in a country that had little to do with, more to do with the sort of colonial history of that country and less to do with the historical accuracy. A little bit of fact-finding opens up a lot. Just want to bring you back to 17th century stuff. Is that okay? 1660. There's a, and this is from a part of the world known as Edinburgh. Not all members of the Mason trade benefited equally from the building activity in the first few decades after 1660. Why is that important? You need to do a little bit of that homework for yourself. But in the medieval ideal of craft organization, a man would progress from apprentice to journeyman and then eventually to master. And thus, though men at different stages of their careers might well have conflicting interests, all would be following the same basic pattern and expecting to reach the same goal. An apprentice or journeyman might be frustrated by the power of master or employer over him, but he would look forward to being a master himself one day. However, this ideal was not always maintained in practice, and a common type of distortion led to a situation in which many apprentices and journeymen found that they had little or no hope of becoming masters. This could arise from a number of different circumstances or combinations of them. General economic difficulties in a craft leading to stagnation or decline after a period of expansion. And I think that's happening, at least in masonry around me. I could be wrong. You know, after expansion, there's a shrinkage. Yeah. The admission of too many apprentices. Who's to say? You know, if there's enough work to go around and changes. And I think we want to, I would always like to have a little lodge with some entered apprentices on hand for the emerging work that's coming. Yeah. The changes in structure leading to the craft being dominated by a few masters. That makes sense. Whatever the reason, the result was that the perceptions of journeymen to change, they were less likely to identify with the interests of masters now that they had no chance of themselves becoming masters and would spend their lives as wage-earning employees. The result was often the emergence of fraternities or guilds composed exclusively of journeymen, set up to represent their interests as these now conflicted with those of the masters who dominated the traditional guilds. Such organizations can be traced to the late Middle Ages in England and elsewhere. Among Masons, such journeyman organizations emerged in France as the Compagnons for their own secrets and rituals. In the Mason trade in the late 17th century, Edinburgh distortions of this sort were present. Expansion in building activity evidently led to masters taking increasing numbers of apprentices, old rules limiting the number of apprentices a master could take being abandoned to increase the labor force. The first SCA statutes had been remarkably restrictive in limiting apprentice numbers, ruling that a master could only have three in his entire career. Mary Chapel Lodge in the first half of the century had attempted to control apprentice numbers, but thereafter some Masons seemed to have taken apprentices freely, restrictions collapsing or being evaded. Moreover, much of the work generated by increased building activity seems to have been monopolized by a relatively small number of masters. Outstanding among them were successful architects and businessmen like Robert Milne and James Smith, employing substantial numbers of journeymen and indeed other masters. Many in the growing labor force created by the expansion in apprentice numbers came to realize that they had little hope of becoming masters. To become Mason burgesses and members of the incorporation was an expensive process. The fees for joining the incorporation of Mary's Chapel alone amounted to £104, which was of the order of 6 months' full-time wages for a journeyman, and work was often irregular. Even if a journeyman did manage to become a mason in the incorporation, with the trade dominated by a small number of well-off masters, he was likely to find himself still having to work for wages from one of them. Thus, strains within the trade were growing even when times were good for the industry. And these were greatly exacerbated when economic stagnation of the 1680s was followed by the disasters of 1690s, with the decline of overseas trade and widespread famine. For the journeymen and lesser masters, the problem may no longer have been resentment at having to remain a wage earner, but the difficulty of making a living as one. A little reality, yeah? If, however, it was basically a widening gap between the interests of different groups within the ranks of the Masons, which led to disputes and schisms in the late 17th century, why were these feuds fought out in the lodge rather than the incorporation? It was the latter that had legal power to regulate the trade, and it has been argued above the role of the lodge in supervising the operative trade was sporadic and limited. The answer lies in the fact that the incorporation consisted only of masters, whereas many journeymen were members of the lodge. Thus, the lodge provided the journeymen, whether entered apprentices or fellow craft masons, with a forum in which to express their grievances. Kindred spirits. A little bit of history from the past. And who would have thought? That's it for today. We're going to move on. Thanks for joining. I hope we've been helpful. I look forward to being with you again next week. We have an interesting, more interesting commentary. Don't you think we live in interesting times? Now more than ever, we need to maintain our faith and our conviction and our commitment to each other. Remember your obligations in the third as we go out and face the world around us. The world, life is not conflict. Life is not meanness. It's not insulting your fellow man. It's something more. You know what I mean. It's a little something from France. Beautiful, beautiful music. I look forward to having you here. Thanks all. Commit those acts of Masonic kindness. If you're still around, check this out. This is Brazilian pianist. Program's over, but you might like this. Eliane Rodriguez. She was working with one of the pedals on the piano broke at a recital in Rotterdam. Check out what happens.
Thank you. Hindi niya. Kung dapat nang tindaw, ito sa kiyo. Hello? This is Emma. Sorry.
Thank you. And you can tell everybody
Yo no